Blog Talk Radio.
Internet world. I'm Randy L. Noble, and welcome to The Cross in the Desert, speaking hope and freedom to Iran. It is the Thursday edition of my program, The Cross in the Desert. So glad that you've taken out some time from your busy schedule today to join me on the program. Very special program as always today. We're going to talk live in just a couple of minutes with a good friend of mine. She's an Iranian-American human rights activist. She's been on the program before. Her name is Danya Jam, and our subject this morning is about literally the miracle of Camp Liberty. Camp Liberty is a place, or was a place, I should say, in Iraq, where Iran dissidents were held captive for many, many years and literally tortured by the Iraqi government, especially the Iranian regime. Many, many deaths there from rocket attacks. Well, a miracle happened just maybe a couple of weeks ago. They have been resettled and relocated all the way into Albania, and now they are safe. We're going to talk about that on the program today because we've had many programs dedicated to all of the residents in Camp Liberty. Also on today's program, going to read to you a little article about a movement afoot among Iranian activists who are urging the United Nations to prosecute the mullahs for the 1988 political activists massacre in Iran, where over 30,000 dissidents were killed. 30,000 political prisoners were put to death when Khomeini was still the supreme leader. It is one of the most awful, just awful atrocities against humanity. And Iranian activists, 28 years later, are saying that this needs to be prosecuted in an international court. Well, right now on The Cross in the Desert, I have the pleasure of welcoming to the program my good friend, Danya Jam. Good morning, Danya, and welcome to The Cross in the Desert.
Hi, dear Randy. Thank you very much for inviting me to speak. I have some good news I'd like to share with your listeners, and I say hello to them, and I'm very eager to share this news.
Well, I am too. This is an incredible story. But before you do that, Danya, just for the sake of some first-time listeners, tell them a little bit about yourself and what you do.
Sure. Currently, I'm a student. I got my bachelor's in political science in May, and I'm continuing with my studies, and I'm also a human rights activist, you know, just working to try to be a voice for the Iranian people, because as you know, the current regime, some of you may know, the current regime is very brutal, and it tries to silence the Iranian people, and therefore, you know, the Iranian people need voices. They need people to speak up for them, and I try my best, along with other activists, to, you know, for us to raise our voices, to be a voice for the Iranian people.
Yes, you are very dedicated. You've been a guest on my program many, many times, and I first met you when you were doing a rally in front of the White House a couple of years ago, protesting against Irani and the execution. So I'm so glad that you have got some good news today on the program. Both you and I have done some programs bringing attention to the plight of the Iranians, the Iranian dissidents in Camp Liberty in Iraq. Many deaths, many rocket attacks by Iraq and the Iranian regime. It's just horrible human rights atrocities, but we have some good news this morning for those that have been following that story. And Danya, share that good news. It's a real answer to prayer.
Yes, this has been a story that you have been reporting for years now, and I wanted to thank you for that. Just the story is very long, and I'd need to speak for hours and days if I wanted to explain it all. But long story short, the residents of Camp Liberty, who are they? They are opponents of the Iranian regime. They are members of the People's Mujahideen Organization of Iran. And, you know, they oppose the Iranian regime. They say that we need democracy in Iran, we need human rights in Iran, and they support and are seeking the overthrow of the Iranian regime. And it began in Camp Ashraf, the story, but just to summarize it, they were told that they have to leave Camp Ashraf. And so Camp Liberty became, it was supposed to be just a temporary transit location until they're transferred to third world locations. But unfortunately, that process took so, so long, and so many residents lost their lives due to medical sieges, due to restrictions imposed on them by Iraq and the Iranian regime forces. And, you know, many, they were put under severe torture. And on top of that, they were under constant threat of getting attacked by, you know, missile attacks and just massacres. They were under constant threat of that. And many times, as we've spoke, Randy, as you've let and me and others speak about on your radio, many times the camp, whether in Ashraf or Liberty, had been attacked by Iraqi forces, by Iranian regime forces, and many residents lost their lives. And even in August of 2000, go ahead, yes.
Go ahead. Continue, please.
I was just going to say, even again, in August of 2016, I remember reading on the NCRI webpage, for those that don't know, NCRI is the National Council of Resistance of Iran. They reported that another threat of attack is, there was another threat of attack. And, you know, this is Professor Cantor and Colonel Wesley Martin. They had written a letter to President Barack Obama, along with other national security advisors, officials, saying that, you know, you need to act. There's another attack that's probably going to happen if you stay silent. And we received news last week that, every single resident of Camp Liberty was able to leave Camp Liberty, where they were transferred to Europe and Albania. Majority of them went to Albania. And I'll go ahead and speak more, but I know you wanted to say something, Randy.
Well, there had been many prominent senators, John McCain, who had stood up Newt Gingrich, who had stood up and brought awareness to the government, to the president, to the Obama administration, that these people are suffering so much, and so much national attention had been given to them. And then when we thought all hope was lost, as you just mentioned, there was a resettlement that took place. And really, Donya, with all of the national attention, with the programs that we have done, with prominent senators speaking up, God really answered prayer. When we really come to the point of how this happened, would you agree it's really a miracle that they're still alive and a miracle that they've been resettled?
I could not have said it any better. It was truly a miracle. It was the tireless efforts of, you know, activists. It was the tireless efforts of those protesting. It was the tireless efforts of different senators, of congressmen and women and people that cared. And as you mentioned, a big name here, Senator John McCain, his tireless efforts. Just different officials and, you know, people that work in Congress, they worked tirelessly for these Iranian residents in Camp Liberty, and they gave them a voice. And because of their efforts, you know, it was like a team effort. Because of everybody's efforts, it was really a miracle, because the Iranian regime wanted to annihilate all of them. They didn't want one of these residents to be alive. And that's why it's truly, truly a miracle. And our prayers were answered, and it's such a blessing. And it's so, it makes, you know, it's such happy news, because they're alive, they're safe. And this was while they were under constant attack by Iranian regime forces, by Iraq. And truly, like you said, it was a miracle that they're all safe now. Every single resident was able to be transferred from Camp Liberty to Albania, and it was teamwork, great teamwork.
Do you know, Donya, this is the 28th anniversary of one of the greatest blights against humanity, the 1988 massacre in Iran, where Khomeini ordered 30,000 political activists, a lot of them MEG members, to be killed. Do you find this interesting, when we think about this is 28 years ago that this happened, that this also, this year, is the same year that these Camp Liberty residents, during this anniversary of the horriblest tragedy against humanity, it was during this time that a ray of hope happened, and these Camp Liberty residents at this time were allowed freedom?
Yes, yeah, you make a very good point. The massacre of the 1988 massacre of political prisoners was a horrific, horrific, dark time in Iran's history. And as we are working to get justice for those victims, as we are working try to get the international community, get the United Nations to set up a tribunal to bring the perpetrators to justice, it's, you know, very good news that we were able to get those people from Camp Liberty out of Albania. And this will, you know, we will be able to put more energy on this campaign to bring Iranian regime officials to justice. And we will be able to bring, put more energy into supporting regime change for Iran, because that's truly what they need. They need freedom. They need democracy. And, you know, our focus is going to be focusing on bringing the perpetrators of the 1988 massacre to justice, where 30,000 political prisoners were massacred, and many of them were members of the People's Mujahideen Organization of Iran. So we really need to focus our energy now on this massacre and bringing to light what happened in 1988.
Tell us a little bit about what you know, what will happen now to these Camp Liberty residents now that they have a brand new life and freedom. What's going to happen in their lives in their new location? What is the future for them?
Yes, I don't know every detail, of course, but, you know, as I follow the news on the NCRI webpage, you know, they're all in Albania or different parts of Europe, and I actually got to meet, you know, there were some residents from Liberty that had been transferred, two European countries that I got to meet, you know, previously before the resettlement of last week. And, you know, a few months ago, I got to meet some of them, and they're working actively, participating in protests against the Iranian regime. You know, they're members of the Iranian resistance, so they're putting all their time and energy on, you know, helping the resistance movement, and, you know, participating in protests and campaigns. And this is, you know, they're going to continue their resistance against the Iranian regime. It doesn't matter what part of the world we're in. We all can play a huge role. It doesn't matter, you know, if you're in Iran or not in Iran. What's important that is that you're actively involved in supporting regime change in Iran. And I just wanted to mention that, you know, it's, you don't have to be in Iran to resist against the Iranian regime, but no matter where you are in the world, we all have a role in giving a voice to the Iranian people, and that's what they're going to continue to do, you know, and that's through participating in protests and helping the Iranian resistance. This is how we're going to move forward.
Great. Now, you know, Danya, in just 5 days, the UN General Assembly is going to hold its annual session, and President Rouhani is going to be attending. Now, you're going to be involved in a protest. This happens every year around this time in New York, where we say no to execution and no to Rouhani. Tell us a little bit about this upcoming protest.
Sure, I would love to. This is actually a protest that's very dear to me because I've been attending these protests since I was very little. They mean a lot to me, and I know they mean a lot to everybody, all Iranians, because, as you mentioned, the Iranian regime president, unfortunately, he is coming to speak at the General Assembly. And in the first place, we ask, why is this terrorist allowed to even step on American soil? But regardless, we uphold our responsibility by protesting against him. As you said, we're going to be saying no to executions, no to torture. Since Hassan Rouhani came into power, almost 3,000 people have been executed, and that includes political prisoners, that includes women, juveniles. It's appalling. The human rights situation there is appalling. And on top of that, the Iranian regime is, as the State Department says, one of the most state sponsors of terrorism in the world. And this means it's not just the responsibility of Iranians, but everybody has a responsibility to be there to protest against Rouhani. And another big thing to mention, they are meddling and helping the Bashar al-Assad regime in Syria, and they're helping Assad by massacring and dropping bombs on Syrian people. And, you know, this is a humanitarian cause, that this is a humanitarian protest that we're having in front of the UN. So I wanted to invite all of your listeners to please attend this rally to help the people who are suffering so much, and help give a voice to them, because they really, really need it, and they really need it.
Well, Danya, that's exactly right, because this is so important, because we see the fruit, the result of the hard work of protests. As a result, Camp Liberty residents can go free because we never give up. We keep fighting. Question. This is a big election season. This next administration has got to be an administration that stands up against the Iranian regime. Does it trouble you that this present administration, the Obama administration, stooped so low as to pay over $400 million in ransom to the state sponsor of terrorism? How do you react to that?
It's absolutely shocking to me. I honestly don't even know how to react. It's appalling. You know, when you're helping this regime, you're going against all the principles that you stand for. You know, America is a country based on democratic principles, based on justice, based on freedom. And when you see that, you know, it's just so contradictory. You know, it makes no sense why they are doing this. And even at a time where the Iranian regime is helping the Bashar al-Assad regime, You know, the money that they're giving the United States government is giving to Iran is not going to the people. It's not going to help the Iranian people. It's going to help, you know, the Assad regime. And even Obama has spoken against Assad, has said he needs to step down. So what kind of message is this? When you're sending money to Iran, you're only going, this money is only going to help the Iranian regime increase its terrorism and, you know, help the Bashar al-Assad regime kill even more Syrians. It makes absolutely no sense. And I know me and you aren't the only ones outraged about this. There's actually many senators and congressmen and women that are outraged just as much as we are. And we'll see what happens. But I've heard many are going to, you know, take action in Congress. So we'll see. And it's absolutely appalling that Obama, the Obama administration, is giving the Iranian regime such help at such a, you know, it just doesn't make sense to me at all. But I hope that the people who are taking action against this to block money from going to from the U.S. to Iran, I hope they're able to put a halt to it. We'll see.
Yes, you're exactly right. You know, I talk a lot with my Iranian friends, just like you, Donya. And the thing that shocks me is that I have Iranian friends that say to me that they are going to vote for Hillary Clinton because she's a woman and understand where they come from in Iran, how women are oppressed. Donya, do you find it just shocking to hear that there are some Iranians that will vote for Hillary Clinton when she is not trustworthy? She has committed crimes against us with the emails, compromised our national security. Do you find that hard to believe?
Yes. I mean, at the end of the day, you know, everybody is entitled to their own opinions. They could vote for whoever they want. Just wanted to mention that. But, you know, from my point of view, she's, you know, like you said, you know, just hearing things like Benghazi, like that story that happened there, and just, you know, her, we have a feeling that she's going to probably continue Obama's policy. If I remember correctly, she wasn't opposed to the Iran deal, if I do remember correctly. But, you know, in my point of view, I don't think she's going to be the person who's going to be able to help the Iranian people the most, just because of her past. At the end of the day, you know, no disrespect to anybody who wants to express their opinions, express support to her, no disrespect at all. But from my point of view, I don't think that she's going to be able to be of much of help to the Iranian people just because of hearing from her past. And also, she, you know, she's very close to President Obama, and I don't think that she would oppose the Iran deal. I don't think she would change anything about it. Many senators and congressmen have been actually outraged at this Iran deal, I haven't seen such reaction from her. So we'll see what happens. But from my point of view, it doesn't seem that she has a strong stance against the Iranian regime as others may have.
You would agree that this next president, whoever that may be, needs to be a president that stands up strong against what's happening in Syria, especially with Putin, and it's going to be a president that has to stand strong against the Iranian regime and not compromise, and that president needs to be a voice like us for the human rights of the Iranian people. This president has done very little to address that, has done nothing but talk about the nuclear deal and his legacy. So wouldn't you agree that this next president has to be very strong in foreign policy, especially against Iran and what Iran is doing to its own people? Would you agree?
Definitely, definitely. We definitely need a strong president here that will uphold, you know, its principles that it believes in. We're not asking for too much. The United States, it's, you know, founded on principles of justice and democracy, and it's not asking for too much. You know, we just say, if you believe in these principles, then why not support the Iranian people? Why not support the Syrian people who are working to gain the same rights. They want freedom. They want democracy. And whoever becomes president, I hope that they do take this seriously, that the Iranian regime is a big, big problem today. They are the epicenter of terrorism. They are one of the worst human rights violators, regimes that are in power today. So we really hope that the next president does take it seriously, does address this problem, and does help the Iranian people on their quest for freedom, the Syrian people, who they're under so much pressure and torture and execution. And because of the Iranian regime's meddling, the Middle East, they're destroying the Middle East. And any president that comes into power, which will be very soon, next in the United States, they have a huge responsibility to take action, to be the Iranian people's voice, the Syrian people's voice, before the Middle East is destroyed.
Yes, and you're so right.
Even
this
further.
President has to be very strong, because it's a powder keg. It's waiting to explode. We can see it on the horizon. I want to thank you so much for the hard work that you've done for Camp Liberty, for being a voice to these people. And one more time, a very important event. Everyone needs to come next Tuesday, which is September 20th, for the big rally to say no to Rouhani. And tell us where the location is and the time is, Donya.
Sure. The protest will be held in front of the United Nations. The address is Hammersgold Plaza. It will begin at 10:30 a.m. And you can't miss us. You'll definitely see us. It's right in front of the United Nations, Hammersgold Plaza, 10:30 a.m. And I hope to see you all there.
Amen. It's been such an important time to be with you, Donya. I rejoice with you in the good news for the Camp Liberty residents, but the hard work continues, and you're not going to stop, and I'm not going to stop until there is a regime change in Iran.
Definitely, exactly. This was a big victory for the Iranian resistance and all human rights activists, for you, Randy, for everybody who's been working for Camp Liberty. This was a huge, huge victory. But this is not where it – this has to, enable us to work even more for regime change. We have to be louder. We have to be stronger. And we're going to carry on until the Iranian regime is overthrown and until the Iranian people have freedom, democracy, and human rights.
Yes, and I join with you and support you, Donya, and all of the those that work so hard with you. I want to thank you for spending some time with us today and sharing with us this wonderful story and urging us to continue the fight until there is real freedom. God bless you, Donya. Thank you so much for being a guest on my program.
Thank you so much, dear Randy. Thank you to all your listeners. Congratulations again, and take care. Thank you.
That was the voice of Donya Jam, and I didn't mention this. There is a picture of her as a young child getting ready to go out and protest, and I see it on her Facebook page. She is very dedicated. I wrote a story about her in my book. She actually sent it to me in an email, and it's in my book, The Cross in the Desert, Speaking Hope and Freedom to Iran. I wanted to continue to talk a little bit about something we spoke about. Iranian activists are busy urging the United Nations to prosecute the mullahs for the 1988 political massacre where over 30,000 political prisoners were put to death. And even to this day, there are some families that don't even know where their husbands or sons are buried, because this never been revealed to them. And so a group of Iranian activists from the part of Iran, I think it's the southeast section of Iran, have penned a letter to the Secretary General of the United Nations, Ban Ki-moon, and they're imploring him to seek criminal charges against the mullahs regime for their part in the 1988 massacre of the 30,000 political prisoners. And this was a letter written on August 13th declaring that the Iranian regime, quote, takes pleasure in the murder of opposition activists and to the international community has not held them to account for this bloodshed. And part of the statement in the letter reads, quote, the mullahs regime has been condemned 62 times for the violation of human rights And it's President Hassan Rouhani with his so-called slogan of moderation and prospect rules as the president, quote, of executions. Now, in the letter, they state that Rouhani and the supreme leader, Al-Khamenei, are dictators whose crimes can be seen across the Middle East, including, as Donya mentioned, Syria, Iraq, and Yemen. And unless they are dealt with, the world will never see peace. And so this is a very important letter written to the United Nations and for the purpose of crying out for the blood of those 30,000 people that were killed during 1988 and 1989. And the Iranian regime did everything they could to keep it concealed, to keep it secret. But, of course, you can't. And their blood literally cries out to us from their grave somewhere in Iran. Just a horrible, horrible dark day for humanity, and they need to be held accountable for what they have done. Well, speaking of holding people accountable, the families of the 9/11 victims have decided they need to have their day in court in suing Saudi Arabia. I want you to hear this special report, and then we're going to have an interview with one of the families who lost their loved ones and what they think about this current act that has been passed where families can sue the Saudi Arabian government for crimes against humanity. Let's listen.
Well, the House has approved legislation today by voice vote that will allow families of victims of 9/11 to sue the government of Saudi Arabia. Now, this was a measure that was passed by the Senate in May. And, of course, the White House has expressed concern, opposition to this bill. It's now making its way to the president's desk. He has indicated that he is going to veto this. Earlier this year in April, President Obama talked about how the consequences would be, for example, allowing people in other countries to sue the United States. He said, if we open up the possibility that individuals in the U.S. can start routinely suing other governments, well, then we're also opening up the U.S. be continually sued by individuals in other countries. But, of course, this really isn't much of a concern to the president if you consider the fact that one of the most pressing issues with the Trans-Pacific Partnership is the fact that we're going to have these independent tribunals that can override the laws of sovereign nations, including the United States. Probably what the president is more so concerned with are these threats by Saudi Arabia that they're going to have economic fallout if Congress dares pass this bill allowing the families to sue the Saudi Arabian government after the declassification of the 28 pages showed ties linking to high-level Saudi officials. Back in April, they said that they were telling the Obama administration and members of Congress that it would sell off hundreds of billions of dollars worth of American assets held by the kingdom if they dared do this. Now, Hillary Clinton has indicated that she's going to be showing up to the memorial there on 9/11 there with the families, which, of course, is going to be a slap in the face to these families because not only was she part of the administration that stalled the declassification of the 28 pages because they didn't want to ruffle feathers there with their Saudi Arabian allies, but, of course, are these families going to ask Hillary Clinton to return the money that she continues to take from Saudi Arabia? They're helping to finance her campaign. Nobody wants you there. Now, of course, Julian Assange has come out and said that he has tens of thousands, possibly as many as 100,000 pages of documents of different types that are related to the operations of Hillary Clinton and what she is associated with. And he said this is thanks in part to new sources who have stepped forward after the organization leaked internal emails from the DNC. He said in a radio interview with Sean Hannity that a lot of people were inspired by the impact, and so they've stepped forward with additional material. Very, very interesting.
Well, and the chain of money goes right back to the Saudi officials who are financing Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign. And yet this is a woman that has taken so much money. The Clinton Foundation has funneled so much money from Saudi Arabia, and they refused to speak out against the gross human rights violations, the oppression of women in Saudi Arabia. It's such hypocrisy. I want you to hear a very special interview right now with one of the family members that is involved involved in the lawsuit against Saudi Arabia. Her name is Terry Strada, and she was recently interviewed by Neil Cavuto of Fox News. Let's listen to that.
All right, the House just unanimously passing a bill today that allow families to sue foreign governments in the light of what happened certainly after 9/11. 9/11 widow Terry Strada supports that bill. Terry, it's very good to have you. Terry, are you inclined to go ahead and sue Saudi Arabia if you got this right?
Well, absolutely. I mean, we have filed a lawsuit against Saudi Arabia in 2002. So it's a pending lawsuit right now. And yes, we absolutely want to go forward with our lawsuit. And that's what JASTA will allow us to do.
All right. Now, the little detail there is that the president's promised to veto this. What do you make of that?
Well, I would hope that he would take a very careful consideration of the language of the bill that the Senate passed in May and agree that this is very good policy to pass this bill and allow the victims of 9/11 to have justice, to have our day in court. There's no reason why we should be denied this. Every other American has the right to sue people in a civil court system. Why are the 9/11 families being denied this? So we're here to really hope and encourage him to look carefully at the changes that were made. Secretary Clinton, she agrees with the bill. And at this point, Neil, it would be devastating to the families if he were to take away our hope for justice. And I really hope that he's a good man, that he'll do the right thing and let this bill pass.
Now, he turns it around and says it would be damaging and devastating for future Americans and their families because it would make them targets abroad. What do you think?
I don't see how that could absolutely be true. That is so false. It is not going to put anybody at risk or at threat around the world because we're going to pass a bill that holds Saudi accountable for the damage and the pain and the suffering and the killing that they did to us on 9/11. That's just not true.
All right. So if the risk was there and that American personnel or even tourists are targets because of this, A, you don't think that will happen, and B, that it's overstated.
Well, they can't be targets. This is a bill that's very narrowly crafted to hold people that finance and aid and abet terrorists that kill Americans on American soil. So if you were to reverse that, we don't fund terrorist organizations. We're not out killing innocent people.
But you're granting or opening the prospect for them to do so even regardless of that. You know what I mean?
No.
And that it's just a legal, on and on.
No. It's not. It's not because it is so narrowly crafted to only hold you accountable if you aid or abet a terrorist attack on American soil that kills American citizens. We are not in international terrorism. We are not funding terrorist attacks across the world. So this bill will not have any effect on our tourists, on our military, on my family, your family, and
I hear what you're saying. But what they're saying is that your definition is very different than what they might deem. If we have, let's say, an airstrike in an area, they might deem that a terrorist activity on our part, financed by the United States, and it's going to be, attack time in the United States in response.
Airstrikes are not considered terrorism. That is not a terrorist organization out carrying out a terrorist attack. There is a difference, and you cannot hold someone accountable for an airstrike. It's not the same.
They're going to lie about this interpretation or start distinguishing that way. But real quickly, on the 15-year anniversary of this, and that this is maybe getting decided on that anniversary, how do you look at this day? I mean, it's been 15 years.
It's a horrible day. It's an absolute horrible day. I hate it when it's coming up. My children hate it. All the families hate it. It's sad. It's horrible. We have to remember what happened to our loved ones that day, and we have to also now carry the burden that we're not allowed to pursue justice. I mean, it's horrible.
Now, I had Tom Ridge here and others of that period, of course, the former Homeland Security Secretary, saying we're still vulnerable. More than half of Americans think that something even bigger than 9/11 could happen again. Do you worry about that?
Of course, absolutely. That's another reason why we want to pass JASTA. It will deter future terrorist attacks against our country because it will hold the financiers accountable and it will make them, pay for what they did and stop the flow of money that continues to terrorist organizations today. all this bill does is hold those types of people accountable, and it absolutely should pass. And like I said before, it's devastating if he takes that away from us. And maybe the president needs to put himself in our shoes and say, how would he feel if his spouse or if his children were burned to death or ripped to shreds and brought home in pieces or never at all like my family? Maybe he needs to do that and then say to us, yes, you can have this bill because you do deserve justice. We are like every other American, and he is denying that to us if he vetoes the bill. So please, Mr. President, do the right thing. Do not veto this bill.
Terry, thank you very much.
Well,
thank you very much.
Wow. Wow. Terry Strada is really putting it as plain as you can put it. She said it so well. If the president even thinks about vetoing this bill and giving these families their day in court, would he think about it that way if it had been his own family members, his own children, his own wife? He needs to put himself in the shoes of these 9/11 families. And if he does so, then he can't do anything but step away from vetoing this bill and give these families their day of justice in court. What I want to do right now on The Cross in the Desert, I want to talk to you about an upcoming movie that I can't wait to see. There needs to be more movies like this, and I'm talking about movies that address the human rights violations against women all over the world. A movie that gives a voice to suffering women. And what I'm talking about is a new movie actually produced by the members of the band of King and Country. It's called Priceless, and it's about human trafficking. It's about stepping into the dark world of human trafficking. Now, you know what I do here on The Cross in the Desert, constantly talking about the rights of women in Iran, in Saudi Arabia, speaking up for them, being a voice for them. This movie does exactly the same thing. And let me tell you a little bit about the movie called Priceless. It's a film about human trafficking. It's about true events, of course. It's directed by one of the members, or actually one of the family members of the members of the band of King and Country, Ben Smallbone. And it stars Joel Smallbone of King and Country, Bianca Santos, and many others. It's going to be released October 14th. And this is a story that's inspired by true events. The main character in the movie is James Stevens, and he loses his wife tragically, I think in a car accident. And both his wife and daughter are now dead, and he's unable to hold a steady job because of the trauma of that event. And one day he agrees to get a job where he drives a box truck across the country with no questions asked, just be the driver. But then James Stevens discovers that he's actually unknowingly and unwittingly delivering girls as part of a human trafficking ring. And so now James Stevens must then decide what to do and how to fight and shut down this awful human trafficking ring. Well, the men of King and Country stand up for the rights of women. I want you to hear something about Priceless movement that they have created. Let's listen.
We say to you ladies that are watching and listening, to never let any man disrespect you in relationships, to never settle for second best. So often it seems as though society or culture suggests for women to talk or dress or act or think or feel like they're cheap. But we believe there's a God that says you're priceless. We believe with everything in us. And we wear these necklaces, and they have a framed Australian 1 cent coin on them, sort of a nod to our homeland. I hope you can still tell we're from Australia now. Our accents have been compromised by these Americans. But we wear them as a reminder of a woman's worth. And we have these bracelets as well that say respect and honor on them. And we make them available at every concert and online as well at thekingandcountry.com. And I encourage you to pick one of them up for yourself, a son or daughter, a friend. We've literally seen tens of thousands of men and women, boys and girls, rally behind this cause. As girls saying, I know what I'm worth and what I'm not worth. I know that I deserve to be treated like a princess, that I'm priceless. And as men saying, hey, count us in. We will step out. We will stand out. Chivalry is alive and well. We will treat you ladies as you deserve to be treated.
Well, those are the Smallbone brothers, Joel and Luke of King and Country. They have said that part of the DNA of for King and Country is the idea of respect and honor in relationships, and that women being priceless. He says that we found in our beliefs as men is that people are made equal. And the film Priceless continues the idea that no one is a commodity and everyone deserves to be loved and loved well. It's a movie about the way women are treated in the awful dark world of human trafficking and how they are priceless and must be rescued. And I just can't wait to see this film. And they have my heart. I want you to hear the title track of the song that inspired the movie, written by Of King and Country. Let's listen to the song Priceless right now on The Cross in the Desert.
Mirror, mirror, mirror on the wall, telling those lies, torn, and now you flow. That isn't who you are. That isn't who you are. It might be hard to hear, but let me tell you, dear, if you could see what I could see, I know you would believe that isn't who you are. There's more to who you are. So when it's late, you're wide awake, so much to say.
An incredible song by Of King and Country, and it's all about the price, the pricelessness, the worth, the valor of women all over the world that are so disrespected, especially in Iran and Saudi Arabia. And this new movie will bring attention to the dark world of human trafficking and bring awareness to how women are treated like possessions, as second-class citizens. A couple of years ago, I wrote a blog which really kind of hedges right on what we're talking about, the movie Priceless. And it's the story of one of my Iranian friends, Atifi, who talked about the way women are treated in Iran. Many of her blogs were about the hijab and how women are devalued and made to wear the hijab. It's part of their clothing they have to wear, and if they don't wear it properly, they can be arrested. Well, I asked Atifi another time to talk a little bit more about the way women are treated, and I wanted to read to you quickly her story and then comment about the way women should be treated. Atifi writes, security. The word sounds familiar to many people around the world, but for me, that's not tangible. I would love to feel it one day if I get the chance, and I hope no woman in the world feels the insecurity I'm coping with here. Atifi writes, everywhere else women are praised for their beauty, all the sacrifices they do for the family and for bringing life into this world. But here, that is Iran, when it comes to women, there are no rights, no values. Women are things which must be used. The worst thing about this inequality is that you have to feel it every day from the bottom of your heart. The simplest example that I can mention, she writes, is standing at the street corner waiting for a taxi. Standing there, every cab driver or motorcyclist feels free to honk the horn, stop next to you, and begin flirting with you, saying nasty things to you. It is a reminder that every day you are being treated like an object created to make life full of pleasure for men. It really doesn't matter whether or not you are single or married, well-dressed or not, having a complete hijab on or not. What I'm describing happens to every Iranian woman every single day. It is very devastating to experience being watched and harassed from the moment that you leave home until the time that you arrive at your destination. They feel free to whisper whatever dirty and nasty things that they wish. They feel free to comment on your face and body, and even the minute things that you never noticed in the mirror. Narrating and elaborating this issue really makes me sick of being a woman here. I bet you could never tolerate a single day here. This is from my blog I wrote, I Am More Than Just a Veil. And I want to comment a little bit about what Atifi wrote. While it's true that in my culture, flirting and harassment of women is also a problem, in Iran, it is a way of life, really resulting from the teachings of the Quran and the Hadith. Some of my Muslim friends insist that the Quran is a book that highly praises the equality of women, but when carefully read, it contains statements that seem to teach quite the opposite. For example, Surah chapter 2, verses 223 declares, your women are your fields, so go into your fields whichever way you like. Reflecting back on Atifi's description of the harassment and flirting of men, it's really now understandable why she is treated this way in everyday life. This verse from the Quran essentially is giving permission for a man to treat his wife in a lewd, sexual, and vulgar way. Another example is Surah chapter 4, verse 11, where it says, the share of a male shall be twice that of a female. The Quran is very clearly teaching that when it comes to the issue of inheritance rights, the man is preferred to over that of a woman. One more example, the Hadith, a collection of the sayings and deeds of the Prophet, Volume 1, Book 6, Number 301. The Prophet says, isn't the witness of a woman equal to half that of a man? The women said yes, and he said, that is because of the deficiency of a woman's mind. Well, you can now clearly feel and understand why my dear Iranian friend suffers from this type of abuse and harassment every day. Her culture has been taught that men are superior to women, and they are permitted to treat them as mere sexual objects. Instead of treating women with dignity, honor, and respect, men engage in perverse behavior and treat them as mere possessions for their entertainment. This is the cultural mindset that my dear friend has to cope with every day. In contrast to the Quran, the Bible portrays women with dignity and respect as image bearers of God. Women were treated with compassion and kindness by Jesus during his earthly ministry. In the Jewish culture, women suffered from much of the same treatment like in Iran, and Jesus came in on the scene treating women with the worth and dignity that they deserved. Proverbs chapter 31, verse 10 is a perfect example of showing high praise to the value and worth of women. The writer, King Lemuel, asks the question, quote, "An excellent wife, who can find? She is far more precious than jewels." Verse 25, "She is clothed with dignity and strength. When she speaks, her words are wise, and she gives instruction with kindness." What a contrast to the portrait of women painted by the Quran and the Hadith. Life is hard for women in Iran. They are daily scrutinized by the morality police, making sure they are wearing their hijab properly. And if not, they can be arrested and fined. I want to quote to you in conclusion something from my book, The Rose of Nowruz, where my character, Behera, is sitting at the bus stop waiting to go home, and she has just come to the conclusion in her class, university class, just the reality of what I'm talking about. And she writes, "I am a woman. I am more than just a veil. I am more than what I wear. I am someone. Someone who has the right to speak her mind, the right to be heard, the right to pursue her dreams, the right to be respected, and the right to be treated as an equal. I have the right to live as I choose, the right to pursue my dreams, and the right to be happy. God has given me all of these rights, and no man or government can take these rights away from me. I am a woman, and I proclaim my right to be free." Well, this morning on the Cross in the Desert, we have heard about the priceless value of women, and we've also talked to Donya Jam about great victory for the residents of Camp Liberty. And so when I look over what we've talked about today, I'm reminded that what we are doing as human rights activists has value, and that God does answer our prayers and does stand with us and help us to be a voice for those that are suffering. It doesn't happen very often, but this truly is a victory for those Camp Liberty residents, and I pray that God will protect them, watch over them, strengthen them, and give them freedom and safety in this very cruel and evil world. I'm reminded that our efforts today have been answered by our great God and Savior, who values all people and loves everyone in the whole world. I want to thank you so much for joining me today on the Cross in the Desert. I will see you very soon again on Thursday. God bless you, and have yourself a wonderful weekend. Great.